Mr. Mager.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. The United States was substantially justified in defending the Air Force's compliance with the SBA's longstanding parity regulations. At the time of the Air Force's action, it was
Mr. Mager, doesn't the core of your argument come down to saying, hey, none of this stuff was presidential, so we got tested?
Well, no, not entirely. I mean, yes, that's a component of our argument, to be certain. But we also are concerned that the trial court abused its discretion by failing to address the underlying agency conduct, which is inevitably part of the AJA analysis.
Isn't the trial court concerned that at some point they get to say, hey, this is what we're doing among us, and we've told you, and yeah, there's no binding precedent, but it's time for you to stop?
Yes, Your Honor, but I mean, the cases, I mean, this was not an issue which had been through the court system for a long period of time. The SBA's regulations had been in place for, since 1998. The Court of Federal Claims first got involved in the actions in a ruling in approximately, the decision was issued under seal in late February of 2010, but the judgment was entered on March 4th, 2010. The GGR case was filed in COFC in June of 2010, just in the scope of a few months, during which time Mission Critical was on appeal to this court. So the United States is substantially justified in trying to defend an action and a view of the regulations, which has been longstanding and which the Air Force really had no choice but to comply with, because the Court of Federal Claims decision, Mission Critical, did not invalidate the regulations. It was not a district court decision overturning the regulations, but specifically only applied to the individual contract at issue. So
that's what I thought, that's what I had understood to be the basis for your case or your argument, which was that the Air Force, and that's your client, if I understand.
Yes.
Your client was obligated to comply with the regulation, and the regulation had been construed both by OMB and by the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department as requiring equal consideration. Is that correct?
Yes, although the reality is what the Air Force had to comply with the SBA's regulations. What OMB and OLC simply said that it was a reasonable interpretation of the statute. The real law that the Air Force was complying with had been promulgated by the SBA, and subsequently, Congress had also directed the Department of Defense to comply with the SBA's regulations as affirmed in the OLC opinion.
So my understanding of your argument is, in light of that, you had an obligation to your client to continue to pursue your case. Is that your argument?
Well, it's not per se an obligation to continue to pursue our case. And the Air Force was unmistakably between a rock and a hard place in this case. I mean, they had mandatory SBA regulations that they had to follow. They had GAO and a Court of Federal Claims decision saying you should be going in the opposite direction. You shouldn't be complying with these regulations. But at all times, of course, the regulations have the force and effect of law. In saying the Air Force is my client, it's the Air Force's conduct that's at issue. I wouldn't say the Air Force is directly my client. My client is the United States. But in a bid protest, the Air Force's procurement activities are what's at issue. So it was
on behalf of the United States?
Yes.
So the Air Force.
And they also are. So.
So the Air Force is your client.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why did the government if I understand it, the government in November 2010 joined in a dismissal of the Mission Critical appeal.
Well, that was because...
What was that about?
That was because Congress had changed the statute.
At that point, you conceded that you were wrong? Or
no, we did not.
What happened?
What happened was, and this is found in the joint appendix, at least some of the legislative history is found in the joint appendix at 791. But Congress stepped in and said, GAO and the Court of Federal Claims have misconstrued our intent. Our intent has always been not to prioritize the hub zone program. So as a result, in order basically to avoid this litigation, we're going to simply step in and solve it by amending the statute. It's an easy fix for us to do. And Congress resolved the dispute in our favor. At that point, going forward with this...
But that also cuts the other way. It acknowledges you were wrong in the first place.
Except the only references in legislative intent provide that they were clarifying and that the courts had misconstrued Congress's intent. So while it could be argued that...
Could you go back and deal with the question that my brother had you on at the beginning? You have this string of cases, and yes, they're non-precedential, but they all go the same way. At some point, doesn't a string of five going the same way suggest to you maybe they've got it right and we ought to reconsider?
Not in this context, Your Honor, because first, a string of cases I would disagree with. The contract management cases have something both for the plaintiffs and for the defendants in this case. They held that the hub zone program was mandatory in contrast with the 8A program, which would seem...
Had it cut it down to four, yes, if you want to...
Well, more along the lines of three. It was mission critical and DGR, both of which were litigated through the GAO into the Court of Federal Claims. DGR
being... Talk to me kind of in theoretical terms. At what point do you start thinking, we've lost on this a couple times, should we keep banging our head against the wall, or are we getting a message here?
Well, the record provides that we're thinking about it throughout. I mean, after the mission critical decision at GAO, OMB stepped in and had OLC take a look to see whether or not the SBA's regulations were truly a permissible interpretation of the statute. So I mean, the record provides the government was looking at this again. Now, that case was ultimately on appeal before this court. The reality is, you know, there were two actions that were active at the time interpreting the priority of the hub zone statute relative to the 8A program, one of which was this case. So at that point, it was premature, especially since the United States had appealed mission critical and was going to, before Congress amended the statute, obtain a definitive answer on the proper interpretation of the statute, which the United States stands by as the proper interpretation of the statute. The Court of Federal Claims, as a general matter, also failed to address the underlying agency conduct. I've noted that overall with regards to responding to the court's questions, but I think it bears emphasizing that the Court of Federal Claims, in its EJA opinion, refers to the government's conduct in the underlying litigation. It does not refer to the agency-level conduct, which you need to always consider in an EJA action. In every case, you need to consider what the agency did. And again, in this case, the agency was attempting to comply with the law. The agency was acting reasonably. And in any event, the Court of Federal Claims never determined otherwise.
The court said that your waiver argument, which you're making here, was, I think they used the phrase, patently unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Knowing that we were a patent.
Your Honor, we would disagree with that. The United States was attempting to comply with law coming from this court. In Blue and Gold, the court established the doctrine as arising under the statute. A doctrine such as waiver arising under statute is very much akin to a jurisdictional type of argument. The case was being litigated before the courts. One judge in the Court of Federal Claims has held that you have to have filed in a court in order to ultimately not waive your argument. We did not disagree with the court on the facts here, that DGR indeed did attempt to protest through an agency-level protest through the GAO. We're in agreement with that. At the end of the day, however, after the GAO opinion came out, after they had been informed that the Air Force was not going to comply with the GAO decision, the Air Force again waited to see if there was going to be any further protest before awarding any contract. No protest was forthcoming, and so ultimately a contract was awarded. DGR put itself into a different position by allowing the contract to ultimately be awarded. So our waiver argument, we would disagree, is not patently unreasonable. It is something that I know has been an issue in a couple of cases before this court. There's been no ruling yet.
It may not be patently substantial either. On the question of substantial, Mr. Major, I'd be interested in the government's view of where in the hierarchy of things substantially justified fits. That is, I assume an argument is substantially justified. To be substantially justified, it has to be something more than frivolous. But it doesn't have to necessarily be correct.
Yes.
Would you help me understand between those two dimensions, where do you think substantially justified for your case sits?
The case law says it's sort of a reasonable person analysis. So it's if the United States is frivolous, they're not going to be substantially justified. But not being not frivolous is not enough for the United States position. It needs to be a position that a reasonable person would take, which fits somewhere in the continuum between those. We believe this case, especially in light of the status of this issue before the...
And in brief, what makes your position reasonable? Briefly, summarize it for us.
Well, you know, we had provided, again, that we had SBA regulations been in effect for 12 years. Congress, which renews the Small Business Act every 3 years, had never stepped in to otherwise alter or amend those regulations. Our view of the statute, our reading of the statute, based upon the plain language, was, we believe, justified. We take an approach which focuses on the structure of the statute as well as the language. The court focused upon the language and consolidated the notwithstanding any other provision of law provision with the shall. We believe you cannot sever each provision and apply notwithstanding to each individual provision, primarily because that section of statute doesn't contain any express language with regards to programmatic choice. Programmatic choice is dealt with elsewhere in the statute. Specifically, it is dealt with in the goals section of the statute, which in that case places a greater priority on the small disadvantaged business program as opposed to the hub zone program. I'm well into my time, so.
Would you like to save the rest, Mr. Mager?
Yes, Your Honor.
I just want you to fix something, Mr. Mager, because I think you had one too many knots when you're in your eagerness to be reasonable. I think you said not being not reasonable is not enough.
No, Your Honor. I would say being reasonable is enough. If there were three or four knots in there, I apologize.
Oh, no, at all. I just think it ran one more.
We'll leave those tied.
Ms. Hennessy.
May it please the court. I represent DGR Associates, and where I am here alone arguing their case today, we would like to focus on not the underlying decision of whether you read the HubSpot statute in a certain way.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Ms. Hennessy?
Certainly. What we would like to focus on today is the factors which go into a decision as to whether the trial judge abused his discretion in this case in ordering EJIA fees. And looking at an abuse of discretion standard, quoting Chai versus United States, only if the trial court erred in interpreting the law or exercised its judgment on clearly erroneous findings of material fact. Also quoting RAMCOR Services Group, found at page 20 of the government's brief, the trial court enjoys considerable discretion in determining eligibility for EJIA award. Also,
now let's look at whether the government substantially justified. And the Act itself sets what they call participation goals, targets, And the HUD zone target is 3%. The Section 8 is 5%. So this act itself seems to suggest that you have more need for Section 8 programs than you do for HUD zone projects. So why weren't they substantially justified in trying to meet the participation goals, the targets that the act set forth?
Because the HUD zone statute itself mandates that...
And if they had interpreted it in that way, which would have run contrary to the regulations and established practice, they couldn't possibly have met those goals that were in the act, right?
Not necessarily.
Because every single HUD zone's mandatory and everything else is discretionary, and yet the everything else is supposed to be higher than the HUD zone.
The judge in the Mission Critical case addressed that issue because it was brought up. And the reasoning was that not every procurement is going to be a HUD zone procurement because it just doesn't fit within the rule of two, or there's not two available contractors willing and able to perform. And that in some cases, if there was not, if it was not going to be a HUD zone set aside, then it certainly could be an 8A or small disadvantaged business set aside. And in fact, some groups qualify under both. For example, DGR is an Hispanic woman-owned business, so it would meet four of those goals under that circumstance. So even though the goals might read differently, that does not change the plain language of the statute, the HUD zone statute.
That is, if we read that section in isolation from the rest of the statute that Judge Rader was citing to you.
But if the statute is clear on its face, then there's no reason to read any other statute. If it is, as the trial court found, clear on its face, then there is no reason to look at other provisions of other statutes in that context. And again, they are not necessarily inconsistent. You, on a practical matter, yes, there might be some challenge for the government, but that does not change what Congress mandated, which is that it had to be set aside for HUD zone under 657A if, in fact, they met the rule of two, the two eligible bidders qualified to perform.
If the statute were clear on its face, the regulation would be invalid, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. But as I understand it, I'm hardly an expert in this area, but the claims court doesn't have the authority to overturn a regulation. All they can do is determine whether, in fact, the agency acted in accordance with law. And their finding was that the SBA regulations, in fact, were not in accordance with law.
Now, the government has at least an argument here. They say that notwithstanding any other provision of law meant provisions of law outside the act, that if you looked at it in that way, then you could reconcile these targets and goals because they could properly take into consideration the other programs while still upholding the language of the statute with respect to other aspects of other laws.
The finding of the court is that notwithstanding any other provision of law was a statement about all statutes, every statute, and that regardless of any other statute, including within the context of the statutory goals, this was the statute that applied. If we talk about the legislative history for a second, the government says there's a lot of legislative history that supports that Congress did not intend for the HUD zone statute to be read this way. But there was an opportunity for the government or for Congress to put in a parity provision in the HUD zone statute, and it didn't go in. Now, there's a lot of congressional comments about it, but the fact of it is the entire Congress never had a chance to reject the DGR, the trial court's interpretation of the statute, in fact, until it got changed in late 2010.
Ms. Hennessy, how do you deal with Mr. Mager's argument when I asked him about the string of cases that, oh, gee, they they were, it was over a very short time, so they didn't accrete the way they would over the course of several years to the detriment of rule of law or whatever.
I'm talking a little bit off the top of my head, but I believe the contract management case was determined in 2004 or 5. I'd have to check real quick to see what it was. So that case was decided some time ago.
The district court was 2003. The Ninth Circuit was 2006.
So this was not a new issue. It's not an issue that the government wasn't aware of. Not that the government is necessarily, certainly they can change their mind, but it was actually the government in that case that was advocating that the HUD zone statute read just as we are arguing today, that it is mandatory. Now, the government also mentioned that these SBA regulations were longstanding. Yes, the regulations did come out in 1998. I'm sorry to say I didn't check the regulations myself, but in reading the contract management case on the district court level, they noted that SBA was taking the same position, that the HUD zone statute was mandatory. The only difference was they felt that if a 8A procurement, if a contract was already let to an 8A contractor, then any follow-on contract would have to be let to an 8A contractor, regardless of the HUD zone statute. So whether it's a clear precedent, that precedent in the Court of Appeals, and I might add the Ninth Circuit, which is covers Alaska, where this procurement took place, I can't see that that's not the beginning of a string of cases. And actually, although I didn't cite it in my brief, there is an actually earlier GAO case, International Program Group, that was decided by the General Accountability Office, I believe in 2007 or 8.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to give up my script. I can just go by what was asked on the direct. I'm not very good at this, but I'll try.
Which You're doing is, fine.
Thank you. Is that he said that my client is the United States. Well, that's true. His client is the United States. The United States is not acting in its sovereign capacity here. They are in their operating capacity as a owner contracting with contractors. They are not Department of Justice versus Department of Defense, OLC, whoever that is, Office of Legal Counsel for the President. They are all one party here. And even though one portion of their party might be telling them to go this way, it is still up to the United States as a whole to act in accordance with the law. And if, in fact, the law is that this contract should have been bid to HUD zone contractors first, then they are not acting as one client, as one party, in accordance with law. Because it was brought up, I just wanted to say something about this, why the government waited. They claim that they had the judge did not address the agency's whole conduct during the entire agency procurement. But in fact, the judge did. The judge, trial court, not only on the underlying decision, but in the EJIT decision, went through the whole history of this procurement, how DGR had at each step of the way taken the most, I guess you'd call it the lowest level, the most informal method of addressing its concerns with the government. It first started with an agency protest. When that was denied, or actually no decision was made, they went ahead with the procurement. DGR filed a protest with GAO in hopes of keeping it at that low level. That didn't work, even though we won. They refused to comply with the decision, wouldn't pay our award of attorney's fees, which stands today. And then ultimately, what happened is we're in this gap of time. We've got the GAO decision. There hasn't been an award. So we were in the same position. Just because the government refused to comply with the GAO opinion doesn't mean they were going to go ahead with the procurement. It was unclear. Questions were being asked. There wasn't any clear direction from the government what they intended to do. No, they weren't going to comply with the decision, but that doesn't mean that they were going to go ahead with the procurement on the 8A basis.
What do you mean when you say refuse to pay our award of attorney's fees, which stands today?
GAO, the General Accountability Office, awarded us attorney's fees and costs, which the government refused to pay.
And they have, and still to this day.
It was, and it wasn't a lot of money. It was, whether we were right or wrong, most of the work was done at the agency protest level, and we never asked for those fees or never pursued it anyway. And the fees at GAO were less than $5,000, and we didn't pursue it, although we asked for it and got awarded it. The government would not pay that. So, in fact, the trial court did look at the agency's actions as a whole throughout the entire procurement, not just at the litigation stage, and found it unreasonable. Unreasonable and patently unreasonable in the case of this waiver issue. I don't think I have anything more, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Hennessy. Mr. Mager?
Your Honor, just to briefly address 2 points.
Also address the refusal to pay, if indeed.
We actually did pay.
Okay.
So that was one of the points I was going to address.
Okay.
So, with regards to the legislative history, they say the Congress didn't have a chance to act. Well, Congress, again, renews the statute every 3 years. It had plenty of opportunities to act. The record before the court reflected an ongoing dialogue with the SBA between Congress. And to
yeah,
the extent,
but my problem with your position, Mr. Major, if I may offer it to you, is that the government didn't act very promptly. For example, if my chronology is correct, February 2010, the Court of Federal Claims decided the mission critical opinion against you. August of 2010, the Court of Federal Claims decided DGR against you. In a little over a month from then, Congress amended the statute, if that's correct. But the dispute, that all happened in 2010. The dispute between GAO and OMB and the Small Business Administration was running back in 2009.
Which is when Congress attempted to amend the statute. But in the interim, while the dispute was going on at GAO, OMB had OLC take a look at the SBA regulations to determine whether they are proper interpretation of the statute.
The government trying to get the statute amended to clarify it back then?
Well, a clarification was submitted and passed through the Senate. It was not in the House. It was in the National Defense Authorization Act. It was not in the House version of the Act. So when the versions of the bill went to committee, the question was, well, do we need to amend this statute still? And what happened was the committee said, the Senate is receding because the OLC opinion has come out, the SBA regulations are a proper interpretation of the law, we don't need to change the statute. Department of Defense, you shall comply with the OLC opinion. So Congress did get involved. Moreover, I think the view that Congress did not had rejected parity is slightly incorrect. The regulations aren't just parity. The regulations begin with the consideration of is a requirement in the 8A program. If a requirement is in the 8A program, it stays in the 8A program. If it's not in the 8A program, then it goes over to the parity provisions in which you get a choice. So what the SBA did is considered both the intent of the Senate and the House, both of their concerns, which are well established in legislative history, and provided.
Could you address one last point very quickly, and that is in the contract management cases, you seem to have been taking the position which you now eschew.
Your Honor, we took a position that was slightly mixed. It was in favor of the parity provisions and yet for a mandatory hub zone provision. How you reconcile those two as we sit here today, I cannot provide. I cannot myself, having read through the briefs, understand how both of our positions were consistent at the time. But yes, that is a position we took, and it appears from my review of those cases, we took two positions at the time which may appear contrary to each other.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mager.
Mr. Mager, just for the record, so and to enlighten Ms. Hennessy, where in the record is that payment so she can find her money?
That isn't in – none of the payment dispute is in the record. So that would have occurred.
How would she find it?
She would know because she represented her client at GAO. But she could talk to my counsel for the Air Force, who's here today, if she has any questions.
All right, thank you. And let's go.